From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The writer Mark Singer admits it in his new book. He, along with the rest of the commentariat, misread the Donald Trump moment. He was entertaining in the debates, but Singer thought Trump would be gone by the primaries, and before realizing just how wrong he'd been, he vowed he wouldn't jump into the frenzy. And now he has. Today on the program, Singer will explain why he felt like he had to say something. He had the same kind of reluctance 20 years ago when he was assigned to write a piece about Donald Trump for The New Yorker magazine. But he went ahead, and the magazine's editor, David Remnick, has called the profile the most insightful and funniest portrait of Donald Trump, a classic of the form. Mark Singer is joining us today to talk about his new book, where he revisits that portrait and asks himself, does Donald Trump have an interior life? Join us after the news.
Hey, Radio West listener. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. At first, the writer Mark Singer wasn't going to write anything about Donald Trump's foray into presidential politics. No need to feed the beast, as he put it. Better it should starve of neglect. But then he noticed Trump's typical taunts and insults and threats were drawing crowds to rallies. As Singer writes in a new book, his poll numbers were vindicating his methods, so he jumped in. Today in the program, Mark Singer is joining us to talk about his new book, where he revisits a profile he wrote of Trump for The New Yorker in 1997. In that portrait, he focused on two really basic questions, both, I think, relevant to understanding Donald Trump as the presumptive presidential nominee for the Republican Party. Those questions are, what did Trump actually do as a businessman? He says that's his biggest qualification for president. And the other question is, did he have an interior life? Mark Singer's book is Trump and Me, and he's joining us today to talk about it. Singer's been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1974. His other books include Funny Money and Somewhere in America. He's joining us today from Public Radio Tulsa in Oklahoma. And Mark Singer, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
But before we get to the portrait that you wrote back in 97, I wanted to ask you about that decision you made to write this piece, or certainly follow up on all of this, because at first you've talked about how you were kind of reluctant to kind of jump in, didn't really want to say anything. What was the point at which you figured maybe I should say something about all of this?
It was sometime over the winter in around February, and I just had watched this thing for so long. I really had made a conscious decision earlier that I didn't want to add to the hoopla, I guess, yeah. And I didn't think that Trump would last. And then just the magnitude of that miscalculation by me and the rest of the press sort of drew me in. And frankly, I was sitting there watching all this unfold from my living room sofa. Mm. And it hit me that I think I did have something to say about who this person was when I observed him originally 20 years ago and what he has evolved into and how just utterly weird the phenomenon of a Donald Trump presidential candidacy has become.
What did you figure as you were thinking about deciding whether to jump in or not? What did you figure you had missed and the rest of everyone else who got this wrong missed about? I don't know if you figured this out now, but what did we get wrong about Donald Trump, do you think?
I think we got it wrong about the electorate.
Yeah.
Not as much about Donald Trump himself.
Right.
I think that the thing that has my education in this whole thing has been the lesson about the actual resentment toward elites that exists in a very large percentage of the populace, and it's a legitimate resentment. Both of our political parties have failed over a long period of time, really, to address the needs of, I don't know how to label this, not working class, mm-hmm. and I don't like the label silent majority either, but people who are not in control. The way most of us are not in control, we're all really not in control. There are global forces that are shaping our lives. And Trump quite ingeniously saw how to exploit that. It had been done before, obviously, that the Tea Party had mobilized a lot of this sentiment. And but it was also a lack of faith in government, obviously. I'm not saying anything new here, but these things finally, and then Donald Trump brought to it this remarkable talent for demagoguery that I hadn't quite seen coming. There was evidence of it, of course, in the past, especially with his birtherism back in 2011, but it didn't seem enough to sustain a presidential campaign.
It's interesting. You say in the book that you didn't, there were moments when you didn't really ever feel terribly offended by Trump's lies. And when you were writing the profile, you kept, they were pretty obvious, you know, one after another. And you write in the book, you said, I always knew that it wasn't my intelligence per se that was being insulted. That was just the way the man talked. Do you still feel that way? Like that this is just sort of his hyperbole. I mean, do you still feel that in that same way?
Well, he's not insulting my intelligence now. He's insulting the entire country's,
right.
Perhaps the entire world's. So it's the stakes are just totally different.
Yeah.
I tend not to ask a lot of questions as a reporter. I tend to, if I know that there's a way that I can get an answer, otherwise I don't ask the question. I like to be a fly on the wall when possible. And that was the condition under which Trump and I were speaking for months when I was reporting this profile that I originally wrote 20 years ago. And it was kind of amusing. I've always felt as a reporter that the very best thing that can happen to you is if you're underestimated by the person you're writing about or whomever. I suppose that doesn't paint a totally flattering portrait of me, but that I'm sort of sitting there silently judging. But that's the fact is that you accumulate facts and you reach conclusions. I did a lot of reporting, and I knew that it wasn't about me at all. Donald Trump doesn't have any curiosity about anyone but himself.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't discriminate. He's happy to spin his sort of mendacity toward any audience. It wasn't personal for that reason.
Yeah. You talked about how your first impression when you finally meet Donald Trump face to face is that he was a performance artist. I've heard you say that. Would you explain what you meant by that?
Well, this was really, I think our initial discussion was in his office sometime in the fall of 96. And I came away from it. I went back to my office and I said to someone, this guy's a performance artist, by which I meant that it was plain to me that he was living the life as a persona, not as a human being with sort of frailties that each of us is familiar with because we know ourselves, and that he had elected to brand himself as a business proposition, but that it also meant living a life that didn't really comport with reality, and just projecting this image of himself. And of course, there was all this material excess that went with it. So I think I refer to it also as a sort of Oprah Buffa parody of wealth.
Right.
And that was interesting, you know, just as a phenomenon that this was really someone who there was no way to know as a person quite. Because he doesn't allow that. You know, he wrote in one of his biographers, I don't like to analyze myself because I might not like what I see.
Yeah.
That's an astounding observation.
Well, I wondered about that because you include that in your book, that it was one of his biographers wrote that. And because it made me, all throughout your profile piece and the stuff that you've written since then, there's this big question about whether or not, in fact, Donald Trump lacks self-awareness. But his ability to say, that's a kind of insightful thing to say to this biographer. I don't want to analyze myself too much, I'm afraid. I mean, that seems self-reflective in some way. Have you been able to figure out whether he, in fact, has the capacity of self-reflection?
That really, Doug, is a question that I can't answer well. I mean, I do say in the book that remark indicates either, you know, remarkable self-awareness or an utter lack thereof,
right.
Or both.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I couldn't I still don't know, but you have to ask yourself, this gets at the question, of course, of whether he knows that he doesn't want to be president.
Right. Right.
We can elaborate on that if you want.
Well, we will. I want to come back to that, actually. I want to get a sense of, let's back up a little bit, because I want you to tell the story of getting this assignment in the first place. This is in 1996. And in some ways, you sort of had this feeling of being beholden to Tina Brown, who was editor at the time, because you were writing a book. It was taking longer than Tina probably figured it should be, and you hadn't been able to write a whole lot for the magazine, I suppose, at the time. So she calls you. I don't know if it was in the office or she calls you up and said she had just had lunch with Donald Trump. Would you tell that story about her giving you this assignment?
Yeah, she called me. I guess it was in the morning because she said, I just had breakfast with Trump, Donald Trump. I just had breakfast with him at the Plaza. You're going to write a profile of him. You're going to love him. He's totally full of, and you can fill in the blank there.
Right,
and you'll love him. And, you know, you're doing it. So he had told her that he was going to enjoy this piece, whatever the result was. So, as I say in the book, I was in a position where I had been away writing this book, and so I had a clear working understanding with Tina, which was that in her office, in her desk, there was a special drawer, and in that drawer was a jar, and in that jar were my testicles. So it wasn't as if I had a lot of room to negotiate. So I went to work.
Yeah, you did. And I have to say, though, what Tina says to you, you're going to love him. You're doing it. He's full of BS. But seriously, what was she expecting from this piece? And what does she or did she at the time actually think? I mean, like, why did she take him to lunch? Why was she interested in a profile piece for The New Yorker?
Well, she'd done this when she had edited previously Vanity Fair. Yeah. And she had burned him, in his estimation. He hated the result then, but he just sort of said, look, they're going to write this piece without me, so I might as well go along. Well, in fact, we wouldn't have written the piece without him. If someone doesn't want to be written about, I'm not Woodward or Bernstein, either one. I withdraw if I'm not wanted. I had to be we had to be an upfront that, you know, I'm going to be needing time. I'm going to be going places with him. So I think that she was very different from David Remnick, the current editor of The New Yorker, or actually any of her predecessors. She cared about making things buzz, and she was much more interested in celebrity than I was, or most of the people at the magazine at the time were. So I'd been there at The New Yorker since my early 20s, and it was still home to me. I didn't want to leave. So that meant I was doing it.
Yeah.
And once I got into it, it was very interesting because I didn't have any clue how Trump did business, and I had to go figure that out.
Right.
And it meant talking more to real estate people than to him, but also securities analysts and some lawyers and just the usual sort of following one's nose that reporters do.
What did you know about Trump at the time, beyond the sort of basic impressions as a sort of this pop culture celebrity? Did you know much about
him? I knew that he had his name on buildings all over the place.
Yep.
I didn't clearly understand that that didn't mean that he owned these things, which I did learn. It wasn't that complicated. For example, in a condominium building in New York, there's all these buildings around the city with different Trump monikers on them. But he doesn't own the buildings. He might have a management contract. But the actual equity of that edifice is owned by the individual residents of that building. So that kind of thing. Also later, because I knew that he'd been through great financial difficulty, he'd been through bankruptcy proceedings, which he denied he had been through. And, you know, I didn't belabor the point with him. I just said he elects to rewrite history. And I knew that because of that, he was no longer credit worthy.
Right.
So any big project that had his name on it was something that was basically him selling his name.
Yeah.
And he did have potential to earn money on the back end of these things. But going in, he didn't put up any money, and he wasn't assuming any risk. And therefore, the reward was concomitant until the thing became a success.
It's interesting, the real sort of understanding you, it seems like you came to fairly early on in the process of writing about him, that basically his sense is that you were his tool.
Sure.
What do you mean?
Well, I as far as he was concerned, I was there to glorify him.
Yeah.
That's all. That's as far as his imagination extended. And I never would say to someone that I'm writing about, you're going to love this piece. You know, this is going to be flattering in any way at all. That's such a fundamental no-no. So there was no reason to say anything other than to be present. And I was giving him as much of my attention as I could. Mm-hmm. And when I was with him, I was happiest to be a fly on the wall. That's the way I prefer to report. And he allowed it.
Yeah.
This was, believe me, not 5 days a week for months by any stretch. It was, you know, in and out. But there were times when it was one-on-one and, times when I was observing him amid a group of people. And it was all a certain kind of theater, more so than when it was one-on-one,
right.
I must say.
It's interesting. And we'll sort of come back to this as well, but he reacted to the piece and then reacts to the piece when it comes up again in Character Studies, this collection of these portraits that came out in 2005. And he said that in one of his books that he immediately knew you were up to no good. I don't know if he said sneering, but he said you seemed to have a chip on your shoulder, and also commented on your physical looks, which I think must say something about him, which we can talk about that later. But anyway, his sense that you were up to no good, I mean, that was just what, bullcrap, right? I mean, he was just.
Well, that's not what he said at the time to me, and there was no indication that he thought that. What he said ex post facto several months later was, when Mark Singer walked into my office, I immediately sensed that he was not much of anything.
That's right, yeah.
With a faint wise guy sneer and some kind of chip on his shoulder. Well, if that's what he thought going in, why did he continue to talk to me for the next 5 months?
Right.
So I think that should cast some doubt on the credibility of that remark. But what he did do was, after the piece was published, he wrote a letter to Tina Brown saying, you know, you told me I love this, you lied. Sort of spurned lover's complaint. And obviously the notion of Donald Trump accusing anyone of lying is freighted with irony.
Yeah.
So then he published this book, The Art of the Comeback, and that's where he unloaded on me, as we just discussed.
Right.
And then we fast forward to the next go-round of that.
Yeah. He kept telling you, this is the weirdest thing to say to somebody who's writing a piece about you, that's off the record, but you can use it.
Yes, it is weird.
What does that mean?
It means you're my tool.
Yeah.
Basically, it means, he said, when I asked him why that was, he said, well, you know, he was obviously saying many, 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 many self-aggrandizing things. So there was some invisible, limit to how much of those he could say without disclaiming authorship. So he would say, you know, off the record, but you can use it. And these words can't come out of my mouth because I sound like a schmuck. Well, if that was true, what had he been doing for the last, 30 years?
Yeah.
So I just found that interesting. And I do think that he thinks that people are there to serve his needs.
Yeah.
That's why I don't think that he really understands what it means to be a public servant.
Yeah. Was he likable at times? I mean, you said there were moments when he seemed like he was funny intentionally. I mean, not funny ironically, but funny. Is that right?
I've been asked this question about several times now. I'm talking about this book. I'm, out discussing it because it was just published.
Yeah.
And every time that comes up, I think, I said he was likable? You know, I cannot remember it.
Is
now,
right?
Of course, it's in the book, so I must have said it and thought it. And in fact, there were times when he could be engaging. Yes, he could be funny, but so much of the time he seems to lack a capacity for irony, and that's kind of what I work with best, I suppose.
Yeah.
So, he might have been enjoyable company at times because he's entertaining. Look, he's entertaining right now, whether you're watching him on Fox or MSNBC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why he's going to become the nominee, I believe, if he survives next week.
Right.
So, because he is a celebrity, and we obviously don't need to dwell heavily on what it means to be celebrated in this country, to be a celebrity. There are so many gradations of celebrity, but he's a big one.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what brought people out in the first place, and that's what made them responsive to his particular brand of demagoguery.
I want to come back to something you were mentioning earlier about the way you see your role as a journalist. In Character Studies, that collection that I mentioned that was published in 2005, you say that a lot of what journalists do is, this is how you describe it, is a form of sublimated voyeurism. It's a cultural anthropology is also how you put it. And I wanted to ask you about that because you like the idea of being the fly on the wall, of being taken for granted. Explain why that works as a technique.
Well, we would have to probably ask a psychotherapist that question, but I believe that it's a professional trait, or somehow we find our way into this business. I'm curious about people.
Yeah.
I truly, you know, when I'm sitting in a radio studio in Tulsa where I grew up, and I had a big family, and I knew a lot of people, and we told stories about each other, I suppose, and I was curious about other people. That's just something inherent in me. But as a reporter, it obviously has different application. Yes, I really am interested in people's stories, and I'm not interested in celebrities. I really prefer talking to people who are accomplished at something or doing something interesting. But I enjoy the fact that when you ask someone like that a question, they do want to talk about themselves.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty passive process that kind of reporting, listening more than talking for sure.
Yeah.
And maybe there is some kind of little power trip that goes on. I'm sure that's true, that there's a power relationship between a reporter and his subject, and the deck isn't stacked evenly in the sense that the reporter has control of the outcome. The subject does not.
In the piece that you wrote, in there's this great moment where you like, there were moments when I wanted you to or wondered if you had asked him, "Hey, Donald, what was your relationship like with your mother, or how did you get along with your father that may have revealed something about him?" But you didn't explicitly, it seems anyway, go there, but you did ask him this. There's this great section in the piece, and I wanted to ask you about, where you ask him about his early morning routine.
Right.
Like, what time does he wake up? What time does he get to the to the Trump Tower at the time where he was, you know, his headquarters? Would you talk about that particular moment? Because I think that these were kind of indirect questions, but getting at something bigger. And this was a really interesting part.
Well, Doug, since you know where this story goes, am I going to be able to tell it on the air?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm with Trump one day, a Saturday, and we're visiting construction projects in Lower Manhattan, one a building he was developing. And then we were heading up north of New York City to Westchester County to look at a couple of country club, golf club developments that he was planning. And we're riding along, and he's driving. Just the two of us, and I asked this question: what time do you wake up in the morning? I knew he does not drink, never has, and he doesn't sleep a lot. So I said, you know, like 5:30, and I said, what time are you at your desk? 7:15, roughly. I said, okay, so you're all alone. You're in your wife's asleep. He was then married, not for much longer at that point, but you're shaving, you're looking in the mirror, what do you see? What do you think? And he had absolutely no way to answer that question. He didn't even respond. And so I kept going, and I said, "Well, are you looking at yourself and thinking, wow, I'm Donald Trump?" And there's still no response, really, just this kind of quizzical look. And I said, "Okay, I guess I'm asking, do you consider yourself ideal company?" And he said, "You really want to know what I consider ideal company?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And he says, "A total piece of ass." Now, you tell me, does this man have an interior life?
Mark Singer is with us. His new book, Trump and Me, joining us from Public Radio Tulsa in Oklahoma. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Mark Singer is with us to talk about Donald Trump. Singer wrote a remarkable portrait of Trump for The New Yorker magazine in 1997. Trump hated it, called Singer a total loser. Singer has a new book where he revisits the portrait, and he's joining us to talk about it. The book is called Trump and Me. He's joining us from Oklahoma, from Public Radio Tulsa. So it's, I wanted to talk, you were mentioning a bit about Donald Trump's previous credit problems and his business. And this question always comes up about his net worth. And you said, you've written that you don't really care that much about that, except I guess it means something now that his biggest selling point as a candidate is his success as a deal maker. So the idea of his net worth, which he's adamant about, I guess always has been. What do you make of what, not just what he's worth, but the way he talks about what he's worth?
Well, I think that's the relevant question. Yeah. It's not so much what his net worth, but the way he talks about it. And I think it's of a piece with the self-aggrandizing comments that he makes throughout. He, you know, how many people talk about bigness, hugeness have you ever met who are that fixated on that? How many candidates for president in a public televised debate discuss their sexual prowess as if to protest too much, perhaps. So there is a deep need to be seen as big, as large, as successful. I'm worth $10 billion, where there's no evidence that that's anything other than a made up number. Simply because he was in a lawsuit. A reporter for the New York Times, former reporter now, Timothy O'Brien, published a book, I forget how long ago, but close to 10 years ago, called Trump Nation, in which he looked hard and he decided that, and this was a really terrific reporter, I mean, an investigative reporter of a high order, and he decided that Donald Trump was worth somewhere between $125 and $250 million. Based on what he could determine, and Trump sued him for defamation, because he sued him for $5 billion.
Yeah, don't leave that part out.
Yeah, $5 billion. I actually wrote a piece in the New Yorker at the time and said, "I don't know Tim O'Brien, but if I were him, I would not just go ahead and write a check, 10-figure check to Trump right now. Just let this thing string out a while." So. This case never went to trial, but it dragged out for several years, and it was finally dismissed after Trump, at a deposition, said that his net worth depended upon his feelings. Yeah. It fluctuated from day to day. Now, that wasn't going to help his case, and that's how the case ended. It's true that his brand is worth a lot. And so he ascribes a certain value to that brand that is in the billions. Mm-hmm. And but that's a pretty, vulnerable measure of one's net worth, I suppose. I think he ran for president this time around as a brand extension.
Yep.
Ploy. It's something that he's done in the past. He's always flirted with running for president since the 80s. And, you know, this is the time he pulled the trigger. It was a different game because of his role in the birther movement. But this idea of needing to appear big, needing to appear so formidable, and he does measure the true value of things in dollars.
Right.
Most of us do not. And I don't mean to be sanctimonious about that. He's an extraordinary example of someone who seems to exist for however he appears to be materially successful. So I'm probably not saying anything very original, but I think that it's simply a need to be big. You can ask. I didn't ask those questions about his relationships with his parents. I'd read things that had been written, and I knew that his father was the huge figure in his life, far more than his mother.
Right.
But and his father would say, you know, you're a killer, you're a prince. So that there's a lot of that that probably goes toward understanding that tendency of his.
Is there any actual evidence that he is in fact a good negotiator?
Well. His first deals, he developed a hotel, and it's right at Grand Central Terminal, 42nd Street. It was the old Commodore Hotel, and it became a Hyatt, the Grand Hyatt. He ended up being partners with the Pritzker family of Chicago. But to get that off the ground, he first of all needed his father as a loan guarantor, and then he negotiated some really good tax breaks. The city was broke at the time that this was going on in the late 1970s, and he was able to win concessions because here was an economic development, you know, thing that was going to produce a lot of tax revenue eventually for the city. And he must have negotiated well there. And I think he was very persistent, and I think that. That is a kind of, you know, negotiating art that he probably does is a master of, but that works when you actually have the goods.
Yeah. It's interesting too because I mean you mentioned he went bankrupt. He didn't denies this, but he makes it back. I think it was in 96. Makes it back. This seemed mystifying to me. Makes it back to the Forbes list, the Forbes 400 list. I think it was in 1996. They list him as having $450 million. Though Trump told you it was more like $2.2
billion. Right.
I don't understand that. Have you been able to sort of follow the money in that sense, how that works?
First of all, you have to start with the proposition that the Forbes 400 list is about as, you know, reliable as let's say, you know, this the assertions that there are weapons of mass destruction hidden in the shrubbery at Mar-a-Lago. I mean, it's not a very, I think, trustworthy source. But he was too big to fail. Mm-hmm. That's what happened. He had so much personally guaranteed debt, over $2 billion worth, that his banks were stuck and they had to let him. You know, they had to keep him alive, really, if they were going to see much back. But they took a bath up, you know, around $800 million. Yeah. Now, I only know how I would deal with that. If somehow I had stiffed anybody, had not paid a debt, had not, you know, treated people to 100 cents on the dollar what they were entitled to, I wouldn't turn right around and brag about how rich I am. But that's exactly what he did. There was an absolute lack of shame, and it's the showman. It's you know, again, the performance art. This was what he thought he needed to get back on his feet, and he then leveraged his name successfully in the years to come. Even when he was not credit worthy, he was able to by using his name brand, able to partner up with a lot of people who did have money that they were, you know, putting up at risk, and he wasn't at risk.
Mm-hmm. You think he's a racist? It's interesting. In the book, you write that Trump branded buildings have for a long time been these safe havens for foreign flight capital. and a lot of this is popular with these multinational, non-Caucasian plutocrats. So, but then you hear the language about the about Mexicans and about Muslims. I mean, is he racist?
I think there's no other conclusion to draw but that he's a racist. That doesn't that is not true of his supporters. That's a very different thing. He is appealing to the basis instincts of certain of his supporters, but that is by no means what I characterize Trump supporters as racist by definition at all. But I didn't see racism 20 years ago. I really saw no sign of it. But I it's hard to escape that conclusion once he launched this assault on President Obama to begin with, and then the things that he said subsequently. I don't know how. Look, even was it Paul Ryan or who has it said that something he'd said was the textbook?
Oh, it's Paul Ryan.
Paul Ryan said that's the textbook definition of racism. His fight with the federal judge in hearing the Trump University suit, one of the suits. So I do think he's a racist, and I don't know why I didn't see that before. I don't think you could, you know, I suppose we could play with the idea that, well, it's all an act, but it's cruel. It's a very cruel act, and so it suggests a lot of other things about this person's mental health. The ability to inflict cruelty, the ability to call Mexicans rapists, drug dealers, the statements that he's made about Muslims, Muslim Americans and non-Americans, the mocking of a New York Times reporter who is physically disabled, the public mockery of this.
You want to mention the Star of David?
The Star of David. How could I forget that? Yes, that's recent. It's all part of a piece. And this is a mentally not well person who's doing this.
Mark Singer is with us. His new book is Trump and Me. And we'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back with the writer Mark Singer. We're talking about his new book, Trump and Me, joining us from Public Radio Tulsa in Oklahoma. There's this moment in the piece I wanted to ask you about where you're writing about this this moment. He's watching this Jean-Claude Van Damme movie. And he asks, I think he asks his son, Eric, to sort of fast forward through or shuttle through all the exposition parts of the plot. He's really just interested in the next fight scene or the next explosion or whatever it was. I wanted to ask you about this because this is a moment in the portrait where he does seem knowing or kind of self-aware, or at least observant anyway, because he noticed that you're laughing at this sort of sequence of what's going on. Would you talk about that?
Well, that's a very good point, and I think that is a moment of self-awareness. And it was also an attempt to stick it to me, which I appreciated. And so we're watching this movie, and you've described it accurately, that his son Eric, who was then about 13, was fast-forwarding through this plot exposition just to get to all the violence. And there was this moment when this guy just delivers a crippling blow to another guy, kicking him in the scrotum. And it's a slapstick thing, and I laughed, and he shouted, you want to print that Donald Trump is watching this, this Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, this, but are you going to print in there that you were laughing too? Well, the only thing to do was to just include that entire speech
right
in the piece, which I did. And that is a moment when, thinking back on about it, that was fun. You know, he was showing that he had a real sense of humor then. And I mean, he has a sense of humor, but there's a difference between having a sense of humor and a sense of irony. And particularly when it comes to himself. But no, this is a person, we've already talked about this. This is someone who's entertaining. Yeah. You know, whether it's in a good way or a slightly unwholesome way.
He talks about this. There's this moment when he says to you that he, what was it, how is it that he put it? The idea is to be confusing or complicated.
Right.
What was that about?
Well, I was just sitting in his office and he was talking on the phone to someone and it was a pretty opaque conversation. Yeah. I was not on a speakerphone. It was one half of a conversation. And I asked him what it was about. And he just said, it's always nice to do things real complicated so that nobody knows what's going on. And I took that at face value, though. I wonder, years later, thinking about that, because to me, he seems quite transparent nowadays, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because I've watched him for a long time, and I don't think that he's transparent to everybody out there because they have to vote. They have to vote for someone, and so we select what we need to select. I think there's a tremendous amount of fear right now in this country, obviously. We've had a terrible, terrible month of July so far. Mm-hmm. And so there are reasons that people seek an authoritarian to sort of bring order to a chaotic situation. There's fear that is there because of fear of all the things that, let's say, led to the Brexit vote, yeah. Globalization, losing control of our destiny as a country. And there's this, you know, genuine resentment of elites because people haven't been well served by their leaders, ostensible leaders. And that need for there are certain people who react with comfort, mm-hmm. who are comforted by an authoritarian figure who's going to come in and make it all right. That's the appeal that he has. And you don't really need to know much about him in order to find that appealing, really. People can look past any of his foibles or weaknesses. During the break there was someone in a, you know, talking about empathy. And this is a person who simply doesn't have it in his makeup, as far as I can tell, for reasons that I already described. Yeah. But he stands in front of crowds and tells them he loves them. He loves them. And love, as I understand it, means that you're able to subordinate your needs to another person's, a person who you love, a person who is more important than what that person needs is more important than what you need.
Yeah.
And I've never seen evidence that that's how he functions, except he stands up and tells everyone that he loves them. Or that, what do they think when they hear that? I'd love to know. Love.
It's funny, and you can overdo this, and I don't even know if you want to go there, but the question comes up from time to time, and everyone's always diagnosing him, he's a narcissist or whatever, but sociopath comes up from time to time.
It does, and I'm glad that you mentioned it first.
It's funny, he says, this is some of the terms he uses, truthful hyperbole, an innocent form of exaggeration. An effective form of promotion.
Right.
And he's always saying, believe me.
Right.
And you write about this. This is sort of a follow-up to that 97 piece. And you write this. You said, each iteration of believe me begged the question at the heart of the Trumpian enigma. Did he believe himself? I thought that was a really profound question. Do you think you've figured that out?
I say that it's the Trumpian enigma because I haven't figured it out myself.
Right. Yeah.
I really don't know. You know, I actually have written a book about a sociopath once, and I've written a number of pieces over the years about con artists. And to be a successful con artist, you have to keep your story straight, you know, to really, and Trump isn't so great at that, but he's, you know, he's been described as a con artist, obviously, by various adversaries. And I just think that he doesn't care is probably the closest I can come. That implies that he doesn't believe himself. But I think that he has some sort of override gear psychologically that just allows him to plow right through that. That the goal is, again, to see the Trump name, to hear the Trump name shouted by the multitude. And that, I hate to use this verb, that sort of trumps all else.
Right. David Remnick writes a terrific foreword in the piece. And Remnick, he's not quite sure about this, but he wonders if he didn't, Remnick, witness the sort of the beginning of the moment when Trump decides he's going to go for it and run for president. And it was at the correspondence dinner a few years ago, White House correspondence dinner, when Obama did his best and others to kind of try to humiliate Donald Trump. All in good fun, of course, but I mean, Remnick's impression was that his desire to run for president was kind of born of humiliation. That's how he puts it. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, that entire stand-up routine by President Obama is on YouTube, and I urge anyone who hasn't seen it to go, just go find it. 2011 White House Correspondents' Dinner, because there's a camera on Trump.
Yeah.
That cuts to Trump and away from Trump while the president is speaking, and he sets his jaw, and he gets this sort of steely look in his eye, and a couple of times he nods, and he almost smiles faintly, but it's not funny to him, and it is a moment of humiliation. And you know, people say, "What's the rosebud?"
Yeah.
Well, there might. I don't know what the rosebud moment is. You asked me this question about his parents, and I didn't ever probe at mm-hmm. that because it didn't seem to. Necessary, but maybe it's just because I blew it. But there is certainly David Remnick was sitting very nearby mm-hmm. at that dinner, so he said he saw this and believed this. Other people who were there say they didn't necessarily believe it. So it just, if you're constructing a narrative of this whole insane election that we're in, this truly bizarre moment in our history, that's a very neat and useful way to construct the narrative, to say that it begins in a moment of humiliation by this person who Trump has been trying to humiliate for years by suggesting that he's other. He's not one of us. He's a fraud. He's a liar. He's hiding something from the American people. Well, you know, you could turn all that right back on him.
Does Donald Trump want to be president?
Well, I think not.
Yeah.
But I don't know that he knows that either. No one who wants to be president does the things that he's done to subvert himself. And we discussed some of them earlier, just these cruel things that he's done. That, you know, when he criticized John McCain, mm-hmm. called him not a hero, I thought, whoa, this is a game over. And, of course, wrong. So there has been repeated offenses against good taste, against decency, whatever, that have not ended the campaign. But there was a person who posted, a woman named Stephanie Sigielski in March of this year, posted a piece online about a meeting that she had in March of 2015, before 3 months before Trump announced his candidacy. She was being interviewed and hired for the position of communications director of the Make America Great Again Super PAC. And she said she was told that he wanted to run second. This was a protest candidate. He wanted to poll at about 12 or 15%, but finished second in the delegate count. And then, it turned out that his message got through, that it resonated with people, and then he was in the lead, and of course then he couldn't back down.
Yeah.
He had to keep going, and I think there, it might seem logically inconsistent. I think that he doesn't want the responsibilities of being president. He's already been on record. His campaign manager, Paul Manafort, says that he wants a vice president who could sort of serve in a capacity as a CEO or chief operating officer.
He wants to be chairman of the board.
Wants to be chairman of the board.
Yeah.
He doesn't prepare. He was, you know, he could be asked, you know, the day before the Brexit vote, his opinion on it, and says, I haven't really paid any attention to it. I'm not a good person to listen to on this. And then, you know, the day after the Brexit vote, he flies into Scotland and he completely misreads what's going on there. He says, they're taking their country back. Well, Scotland voted, right. You know, 2/3
to stay.
Against, to stay, yeah. To remain. So he chooses to be ill-informed. He's had his lean staff, had a terrible fundraising apparatus. All that is circumstantial evidence to me that he does not want to be president. But there's something that supersedes that, and that is the fear of being called a loser, which is his favorite epithet. And I think that those things exist in tension with each other.
It's Mark Singer. Been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1974. His new book is called Trump and Me. He joined us from Public Radio Tulsa in Oklahoma. Mark, thank you very much for taking the time.
Oh, Doug, thank you. This has been a great pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Today, I should mention on Video West, we're featuring a new short documentary that profiles dancer Peter Christie. In the 1990s, when hundreds of men were dying of AIDS in Utah, Christie beat the odds. The film is called Still Here, directed by Utah filmmaker Jenny McKenzie. Screening is part of the Utah Film Center's Damn These Heels Festival. You can watch it at videowest.org. Our thanks to intern Tony Liu. Tim Slover is our technical director. Radio West, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.